Hello, everyone. Sorry. I'm Molly Wood. I know we've graduated from the deep side to the oh, man.
Oh, man. Hey, everybody, I'm Kyle Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. Me and Molly and all y'all talking about tech, the economy, and culture. This week, surprising nobody, it's the economy and coronavirus and what the what. We could talk about volatility. We could talk about stocks. We could talk about the way this crisis is changing. And in point of fact, we started last week, Molly, with the Federal Reserve. So, you know, we're going to do some more of that.
We are going to do some more of that. I mean, this is a public health story, first and foremost, but it is rapidly becoming equally, if not more so, an economic story. Right. And that's our thing a little bit here on this show. It is also a culture story. We found out, you know, for example, South by Southwest will not be happening over the weekend. Many, many conferences have been canceled. You know, the travel industry, every industry is being affected. And we're even starting to see sort of winners and losers. I heard one podcast talk about the emergence of the coronavirus economy.
Oh, that's a good one.
Those companies that might do well. Yeah. Shout out to Dan Primack at ProRata, which I consider my like frenemy podcast. I love it, but I hate it when he beats me. Yeah. Anyway, consider this continuing coverage on Make Me Smart, if you will, of the sort of coronavirus economic story.
And here's what we're going to do. We're going to get somebody who actually knows what he's talking about. His name is Neil Irwin. He's a senior economics correspondent for the New York Times, writes for The Upshot, friend of Marketplace, friend of this podcast, and he is here to explain all. Neil, thank you once again for coming on.
Kai, that's a lot of pressure. I don't know if I can live up to that.
I know.
I wouldn't have said it if I didn't think you could do it, man. That's all I'm saying. That's all
I'm saying.
All due respect to us, Neil. What's going on here?
Yeah. Well, let's start there.
What's going on here? So when coronavirus first emerged several weeks ago, everybody was talking about it as a supply issue, that China's manufacturing sector was shutting down. There were all these disruptions. These were going to cause ripple effects through supply chains into U.S. manufacturers, perhaps create shortages of certain products, things like that. And I think as the last several weeks have progressed, we've realized, oh, no, this is something more complicated than that and more dangerous. It's also a demand shock. It's also, to combat this virus appropriately in the United States, there's going to have to be a lot of activity that just shuts down, a lot of large gatherings of people, conferences, travel, cruise ships, all kinds of, you know, potentially sporting events. Mm-hmm. And the potential of lost demand, lost business activity, as everybody kind of hoards their time and stays home and avoids public places, that's something that could do lasting damage to the U.S. economy.
So as we have a supply shock colliding with a demand shock, I'm going to bring up the R word here. What's your guess on a recession?
I think it's looking more likely than not this year. It's not a given. It's not a sure thing. But I think the moves we've seen in financial markets in just the last 3 weeks, especially around bond yields, mm-hmm. what those are telling us is that there's going to be a meaningful slump in business activity. You know, whether it officially gets classified as a recession or not, ultimately we'll see. But we're going to feel it. And this is something that's going to cause some real pain, again, concentrating those travel and tourism industries and restaurants, a few others. But this isn't going away anytime soon.
Huh. I mean, I am pretty sure that the first time we had you on, Neil, was in the wake of the column you wrote where you said, you know, central bankers are starting to realize that they may not have the tools anymore to deal with massive shifts in the economy. And so we were talking last week about the Fed suddenly cutting interest rates and saying, is this even a tool? And then here we are with really low interest rates and a president calling for more. And you wonder, like, is monetary policy just spitting into the wind at this point? Which it shouldn't be doing, because that's very germ spready.
Well, exactly. Avoid spitting. So before the global financial crisis, the federal funds rate, which is the interest rate that the Fed targets, was 5.25%. So they had all that room, 5.25 percentage points, to cut it down to zero to try and stimulate growth. It still wasn't enough to prevent that from being a quite severe recession, but they had it, and it probably made things less bad. Now we're down to 1.25 already. There's just not that much room using traditional tools for the Federal Reserve to act. But I think the fact that we're even talking about that is a sign of something problematic, which is we're putting all this weight on the central bank to try and solve an economic disruption. You know, they've been the only game in town, has been the common line for more than a decade. But maybe that's just because other actors in Washington aren't doing their part. And I think, you know, people ask, say, oh, what's a, you know, 0.5 percentage point rate cut going to do? You're right, not that much. But, you know, that's why we need other aspects of public policy to be brought to bear to try and minimize this damage.
Neil, you are a sophisticated observer of the politics of the American economy, yes?
I try to be.
Have you met the Congress of the United States? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it's... Right. You know, and to be clear, like, already people are talking about fiscal stimulus, and President Trump has even said, oh, maybe we do a payroll tax holiday. Yeah. And look, that stuff can be constructive. I think the question is, can there be a fiscal stimulus that isn't just throwing money into the abyss, but is really targeted in ways that help the actual problems we're likely to face, right? So so suppose you're a work in a restaurant, you're a waiter or a cook at a restaurant, and you get furloughed or laid off because there's no business in that restaurant. Suppose you work in the air travel industry, in the cruise industry, in hotels, and you're suddenly, your hours are being cut, you don't have an income. You know, things that help unemployment insurance benefits, that provide direct aid to people like that, provide paid sick leave to people in those types of jobs, might be more beneficial than a general payroll tax holiday that gives, you know, office workers who make six figures a bigger benefit than than those people who are actually losing work.
We've also talked about, you know, it. I said up front that this is becoming an economic story, that it's also a public health story. I think we also have not yet taken into account what might happen when those things collide even more. Right? That as this virus spreads across the United States, barring dramatic action, we may see massive hospitalization rates. And by massive, I mean, I think it's anywhere between, they're saying 10 and 25% of people who are infected with coronavirus, even if they recover, may be hospitalized. That we could see a healthcare system collapse. Like, are we talking about recession right now at this moment with just the knowns? And not even taking into account the potential unknowns of a widespread infection?
So I think what that speaks to, the kind of potential strain on the healthcare system, speaks to this trade-off that we have as a country, that that public policy has, which is, you know, the goal, look, I'm not a public health expert, but from what I read and from what experts in that field say, the goal now is that to understand that this virus is going to spread ultimately, but by quarantining people and having people kind of not be in large gatherings, we can slow it and slow the spread enough that hopefully there's a vaccine that comes along, there's better treatments that come along, and we reduce that burden on the healthcare system. Like, the real risk is if millions and millions of people get this in the next few weeks, the drain, as you're saying, on the hospitals, on the healthcare system is so severe that there may not literally be enough respirators to treat those people. There might be a very bad drain on the healthcare system. So there's kind of a trade-off between the public health dimension and the economic dimension. And things that we do to make the healthcare situation better could make the economy worse and vice versa. And that's a trade-off. Yeah. Look, the White House doesn't want to entertain that trade-off, but every public health expert I talk to says that's the way it is.
So on the theory that we will eventually have an economic recovery, and as I think you've written, but certainly others at the Times and everywhere else have pointed out, you know, we are going into this economic downturn, whether it's actually a recession or not, from a reasonably strong base, right? That said, does the recovery to you, as we imagine it now, right, because nobody knows, does it look reasonably sharp and quick, or does it look like we bump along the muddy bottom as we did for the past 10 years?
Look, the common line a few weeks ago, which I believed and seemed sensible enough at the time, was this will be very short term, a V-shaped recovery. You know, there's some shutdowns because of the virus, but then once things are calmed down with the virus, business goes right back to usual, and it can be a few months at the maximum. I think there are reasons to worry it's something worse than that at this point. I think the idea that this isn't just going to be something that goes away overnight, that it is going to linger with us for months or even years, the idea that the weakness of policy, again, this kind of the Fed being at the zero lower bound, all those problems, suggest this might be with us for a while. And again, that's what we're seeing in financial markets right now. If you look at the yield on the 10-year Treasury bond, that's down, it reached below 0.5% earlier this week. It's still around that level. That implies that interest rates are going to stay low for a long time to come, 10 years. The 30-year is very low. That's the way markets are saying, oh yeah, the Fed's going to have to cut rates basically to zero, and it's going to leave them there for a long time. That's pricing that indicates this is a slow recovery, not a fast recovery.
Do me a favor, would you, just because people can never hear this enough and they hear it out of my mouth too much, explain why low bond yields like this matter so much in predicting what's going to happen.
Sure. So ultimately, what the Federal Reserve does, they set a short-term interest rate. They control the overnight interest rate, and that's what they've been cutting. When you read the Fed cuts rates, that's what they control. Longer-term interest rates, 5, 10, 20, 30 years, they don't control directly, But if you're a smart trader in the bond market, you're basing what you're willing to pay for those bonds based on what you think the future of the Fed's short-term policy is. So when long-term interest rates fall like they have in the last few weeks, that's a sign that investors, you know, and these are very savvy investors, global hedge funds, things like that, they believe that the economy is going to be weak, growth is going to be low, inflation is going to be low, and therefore the Federal Reserve is going to keep its short-term rate really low for a really long time. And that's ultimately a very pessimistic view of how the economy is going to evolve over the decades ahead.
I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I want to talk about the stock market for a minute.
Let's do it.
We have obviously seen a lot of gyrations. We saw the sort of like additional impact of an oil price war, no big deal. But I wonder, as we say, the stock market is not the economy and the economy is not the stock market, as Kai says. And with, I think, an important caveat that we are not even at this point at 2-year lows, let alone 5-year lows in terms of recent dropping. But at what point will this stock market gyration start to become more representative of the economy?
So, look, I think the stock market is, it's the tail of the dog that's being wagged. Mm-hmm. It's not the dog. What's happening is happening in the real economy. The most direct indicators of it are in the bond market, as we were just talking about, in the commodity markets, what you're seeing with oil prices, as you mentioned. Stocks are falling for very logical reasons, right? So big chunks of the U.S. economy, big companies are going to make less money this year because of this virus, especially, again, travel tourism, certainly oil companies, energy companies. But this, you know, it's going to spread much broader than that, and that's what we're seeing priced into the stock market. How low the stock market goes, I don't know. It might keep going down. It might stabilize. We'll see. But I think the key is that is more a reflection of what's going on in the broader world, not what's really driving the train.
To be clear, I'm not so much worried about, I mean, I am a little worried about how low it goes just because I am a human and can't help looking occasionally at the investment accounts. What I'm more wondering is, will there be a point where businesses then have to make changes because their capital is affected? You know, like, is there a point where it gets low enough that we have inevitably see layoffs, or we see companies that cannot sustain losing $1 billion a quarter, such as Uber?
Yeah, I think you see, you know, and you'll see it in multiple ways. You'll see it, low stock prices make, you know, CEOs less confident, less willing to invest, less willing to take chances. You know, there could be constraints on capital. So we're already seeing high yield debt. So lower rated corporate debt is the interest rates are spiking, the value of that debt is falling. That's a sign that companies in the future might have a harder time borrowing money than they have in the recent past, reflecting all these risks that we've been talking about. So I think you're right that what's happening in the stock market does create some risks for the economy that could spread around in different ways. There's also what's called wealth effects, right? As a consumer, when you lose 10, 15, 20% of your portfolio, you're less likely to go out and buy a house, buy a car. You feel poorer. So that could have effects. You know, all these things kind of interrelate with each other. But I think it's, you know, the important thing is that for individual investors, you kind of keep your eye on the ball and don't be too reactive to a few days volatility in markets.
So about those individual investors, let's not talk stocks here, but let's just talk people who participate in this economy on a daily basis. If I am a Joe or Jane layperson in Ottumwa, Iowa, what ought I be looking at as a way to sense where this economy is going?
Look, I think a lot depends on what industry you're in and what type of job you're in. I think for service sector office workers who you know, can work from home easily, can telecommute, have companies that are, you know, work for companies that are going to keep doing business no matter what happens, they're probably okay. This is a strong economy as a starting point. As you said, it's our starting point is quite good. Those people are probably okay. If you work in fields that are likely to be affected, if you're an hourly worker where you might see your hours cut or lose your job entirely for a while, that's much more risk. And, you know, if you have savings, it's a time to kind of make sure they're in good shape. If you're, you know, if you're looking at a situation where one parent might have to work from home or take care of the kids, if schools close down, who's going to take care of the kids? Those are hard things to plan for. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Those are going to be very difficult situations for a lot of families if things evolve as they seem to be.
Neil Irwin at the New York Times, explaining things as he always does. Neil, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Thanks, Neil.
Man, oh man. There's the sigh. That was totally unintentional. Did not plan that at all.
You should know, everyone, that in our Make Me Smart Slack, someone actually posted an article about the biological reasons behind sighs. It's not
Is
all
right?
just depression
oh,
and fear.
God. I swear I read the Slack channel. I missed that one. I'm sure I've said this before. I happen to have very big lungs.
Right. Totally. And then it led to a whole question of, like, who knows that about themselves?
Right, that's right. Okay, anyway, moving right along. So, look, here's the deal. Tell us, would you, what this thing is doing to you at your home, in your community, in your work life, because... honestly, and this is not an uplifting thing to say, but I think we're at the beginning of this. Closer to the beginning than the end, for sure. Voice memos and emails all go to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Hook us up, because we want to know what you're thinking.
We'll be right back.
We'll be right back. Sorry. I just stopped.
I got this. Right. I got the easy part.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so this is a slightly awkward part. But before we get back into the news, we really have, I think, been reminded at this point how quickly things can change in the global economy here at home and how much information matters and all the ways that it can go horribly wrong.
Yeah.
So we really, like, our whole, the only reason we host a show called Make Me Smart is that our goal is to keep you grounded and informed. And that is the case across Marketplace. No sensationalism, hopefully, no fear mongering, except my occasional freakouts, but facts and context to help you. I'm just saying at the beginning of this thing, I needed a hug and I still do. Facts and context, though, right? To help you understand what is happening and the connections between what is happening and your own life.
And look, here's the deal. It ain't cheap. Right. I mean, Marketplace is a lean organization, but it still ain't cheap. And especially when there's a story like this one, which will change and affect all of our lives. I mean, think about the financial crisis and how 11 years on, we still talk about it. Right. This, honestly, I think is going to be one of those. I don't think the recession is going to be as bad or as deep, but I think the speed with which it came on and the globalized nature of it is going to be something that we're talking about in 10 or 11 years, even if I'm not here anymore. But here's what we need you for. We need your help. We need, frankly, resources and your support to keep doing the jobs that we do. Marketplace.org/donate is the place to do it. It is public service journalism in its truest sense, and we need your help.
Yep. And you'll get something out of it. Not in addition to our hopefully mostly calm coverage, you will also get our brand new Marketplace t-shirt. When you give $30 or more, that is a deal that ends this week. And I know you need a t-shirt to wear around the house when you're telecommuting. So marketplace.org/donate. You don't have to wear your work clothes anymore. Get that t-shirt. It's really comfy.
So on this whole telecommuting thing, by the way, a quick little PSA here that I read on Twitter the other day. If you wind up being a brand new telecommuter, right, don't do it in your jammies. Get up, get dressed, shower, shave, go to a place you have set aside for work. You know, don't make it next to your bed or your TV. These are all like behavioral economic stuff that will really help you out in the next, you know, 6-8 weeks as this thing proceeds. That's it.
They say that, but it's really for the newbies. No, I'm just kidding. It's true. It's still... especially if you are new, it will be important for you to maintain a routine. And you know what? Call me. I'm here to help, guys.
That's right.
I'm becoming an expert now.
Marketplace.org/donate is where you're supposed to go, because that's what it says on my piece of paper. It also says, now it's NewsFix time, and I noticed that I don't have anything because I forgot.
That's okay. Sorry. We have lots to talk about.
Yeah, and in point of fact, we literally just did my NewsFix with Neil Irwin for 12 minutes, so...
Yeah, I mean,
just saying.
You guys can safely assume it was going to be about the economy.
Yep.
Well, I have two things that are somewhat related and I think will lead to discussion.
Okay.
One is I have been following with interest the reaction of professional sports to coronavirus full disclosure, I have Warriors tickets tonight.
Oh.
And I'm almost wish that they would cancel.
You get your money
so that I wouldn't have to make this, you know, it's like my brother's birthday present and it's a whole like thing
so
and we feel like
do?
We have to go, but
do?
I don't want to.
What are you gonna do?
I mean, I guess we're gonna go.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about it is that the Warriors will have after tonight played two times in San Francisco, which is a city where the mayor has come out and said, please cancel large public gatherings. The symphony has shut down.
Yeah.
The a bunch of museums have closed. A lot of other gatherings have closed. And I have been noticing that apparently money talks and the NBA is still rolling on. And then I was like, hey, guys, you know, we should do a story about this because I think it's fascinating that the American sports world is sort of like getting away with one here. And maybe a casual viewer could be forgiven for thinking that they're dragging their feet a little bit. And then in New York Magazine, along comes the story today. The American sports world is dragging its feet on coronavirus.
Yeah, for sure.
And for all of the reasons that we've talked about, right, the economic impact of closing stadiums or playing games with no fans and having all of the workers go home, let alone the ticket sales, it's a huge deal. But it also, I think, speaks to, and this is what this article points out, and I think it's very true, speaks to this idea that we're having a uniquely American response to this virus right now, which is we're tough. Right. You're seeing people sort of deliberately shake hands with each other because they're it's overblown and it's fake
really?
News and it's
that.
This and that.
Morons. God. Sorry. Did I say that out loud? Why would you do that? Here, let me sneeze into my hand and then shake your hand. What is that?
Right. Because we're so tough here in America. But that gets to what I think will probably go down in history as my most popular tweet ever, because one thing I've noticed about this response that I think is really interesting is that everyone I know, even literally people I know, is saying, well, you know, I'm not likely to get that sick, or I won't die, or these are the people who do die. Yeah. And I keep saying, well, yeah, but if you get it, right? We know that one person infects two people, infects four people. You have exponential growth. That's how you get to a million people at the end of April, assuming we only have 2,000 cases in America and so on and so forth. You will give it to someone else.
Yeah.
And down the road, someone will die. And what I think is very interesting about our response is yesterday on CNN during the task force press conference is the first time that I heard that concept really mentioned with respect to people's behavior. And there's this sort of community response, right? Protect the herd. The fewer people get it.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the sports idea and the concept that there's this sort of rugged individualism where it's really only about whether I get sick and not whether I give it to other people is just all part of a piece, all part of a cultural piece.
For sure. For
that's
sure.
It's going to kill us all.
Totally.
No,
and the people to worry about, honestly, if and when major sports leagues do decide that they're going to, either cancel events or play in empty stadiums, they've got TV contracts, right? So if they play in empty stadiums, the leagues are going to be fine. It's the people selling the beer and the hot dogs that you got to worry about. Those are the ones. Those are the ones.
It absolutely is. And yeah. I think I know it's a divisive topic, but LeBron James saying,
oh, I know,
I'm not going to play in empty stadiums is exactly emblematic of this. Hey, buddy, not about you.
I'll bet you if you ask him today, he'd reconsider. That was a week ago, and this thing is moving so fast. I think he would totally reconsider. One, from public pressure, but two, just reality. Honestly.
Maybe. No, they're still saying it. People are still saying it.
That's ridiculous.
I don't know if he is, but plenty of people around various leagues are still saying it. Other players are still saying it. Hey, LeBron, would you like to come on the show? If anybody knows him, actually, we should just call him.
Molly's plugged in the basketball world in Oakland. I'm sure she knows people.
That's true. I'm going to tweet some people. Be like, we would like to have LeBron on the show and explain why he thinks it's okay for 18,000 people to come into a stadium or arena and be like 2 feet away from each other and then take it home and give it to grandma. Tell me why that's cool.
And he can email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Yeah. There
and,
we go.
And maybe he could subscribe to our newsletter too, huh? Marketplace.org/newsletters. You know, you can get your fix that way if you want more from us. Erica Phillips writes it, although she's out today. I just saw that on Slack. Bummer. She does say, though, it's not coronavirus. She's just plain old sick. So good thoughts for her. All right. Mailbag?
Definitely. Feel better, Erica. All right. Time for the mailbag.
Mailbag.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Amen,
in
brother.
This case, all the things are going to be related. Yeah. Let's just get that out of the way now. As we have discussed, one of the big impacts is cancellation or not of large public events. Some of those cancellations can feel like a no-brainer, but of course, there are ripple effects. I mean, we're even seeing from South by Southwest, which I think was beyond the right thing to do.
Oh, yeah. And really, beyond. It was kind of egregious that they took that long to do it. But that's
I think it was egregious that they took that long to do it. However, we are now seeing that South by Southwest, the organization, is laying off a third of its staff. Like the ripple effects are gigantic of these events. And so Tyler Mayores wrote in to tell us about Expo West, the world's largest natural food products conference, was supposed to take place in Anaheim last week. 90,000 people were supposed to come. To get a booth costs anywhere between $10,000 and $200,000. And he talks about how tough it is for small businesses. Because he said on Thursday, one thing that's happening is these cancellations are coming super late. So Tyler writes, on Thursday, things started to get wild because some of the biggest retailers started to cancel their attendance. The show producers held firm and wouldn't cancel, but indicated that the show would be down by 50% in traffic. Smaller brands had to stay in because of the large cost of attendance. It was such a huge percentage of their marketing budget, and sent us a post on LinkedIn by other conference attendees saying, you know, this booth at Expo West is the single biggest investment I've ever made for my company to date. And it all apparently caused such an uproar on LinkedIn and Twitter that the company that puts on the conference has now created a $5 million fund that small brands can apply for to help them make back some of the money they lost.
That's interesting.
And actually, on that note, Google is doing the same for the city of Mountain View because it canceled I.O. I saw that Amazon today set up a $5 million fund to help small businesses. And that actually, speaking of that sort of protect the herd thing, you know how we've talked on the show a lot about how businesses are like the fourth leg of government sometimes?
Yes, we have. It's been a while, but early on. Yeah, you bet.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
But you could almost say that this is one of those cases when businesses are stepping in and they're saying, okay, we'll pay for hourly workers who can't come to work, or we will set up these funds to help small businesses, or frankly, we will send our workers home to protect the herd.
And yet still pay them. Yeah.
That they are picking up a bit of a burden that government is not.
Yep. No, that's totally true. Totally true.
That was totally related or whatever, kind of related, but not.
No, it absolutely was. And it was a really good callback to a thing we covered a lot in the beginning of the Trump administration when, as you and I both pointed out at the time, that was the only check and balance on what was going on. It was and that was a good callback. Susan Warner writes with a question. She says, how much of the supply chain problems are due to tariffs, trade disputes, or COVID-19? Aren't all of these involved? Here's what's happening. This whole coronavirus thing is coming on top of a year and a half of President Trump's trade war. It's coming on top of his economic isolationism, right? His believing that we can do it mostly ourselves, or as Peter Navarro, one of his chief economic advisors says, we should onshore the entire American manufacturing chain, which is simply not realistic. They are all involved. It's kind of a 1-2 punch. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, one of the things we covered on Marketplace about supply chains and the trade war was how companies are reconfiguring their supply chains, right? Supply chains that took 30 years to build got turned sideways in 18 months. And now what's going to happen as a result of this? We shall see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There you go.
So basically, yes.
Yeah. Well, yes is the short answer. Yes. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'll get a load of me being all verbose.
I just like soliloquied for like 3 minutes. So it's your turn, man.
Yeah.
This last one comes from Matteo in Italy, home to, as you may know, the second worst coronavirus outbreak in the world after China, with about 9,000 confirmed cases. This one is a bit of a mailbag and also answer to the Make Me Smart question all at once. Here's what he says.
Hi, Make Me Smart friends.
This is Matteo from Italy, actually Venice, in the middle of the ground zero for coronavirus in Italy now. One thing I thought I knew is that we were rational animals. Apparently we are not. Starting from the media, the recent outbreak of coronavirus caused more damages to the economy than to the actual people so far. Good luck to everybody. The thing doesn't appear to be as bad as portrayed initially. And again, from Venice, come and visit. There is no risk. Bye.
Okay, so number one, how cool is it that we've got a guy in Venice who listens to this podcast?
But I know.
I mean, that's amazing. But number two, don't go to Italy. Don't go to Italy. First of all, you can't, because the prime minister came out last night, Monday night, and said, we're basically closing things down and you can only travel if you have urgent need and a document signed by the police and all this jazz. So don't. Right. But look, it's a really interesting response, and it shows you how fast this thing has changed. 10 days ago, there's Matteo in Venice saying, come on over. And now the government has said, no, you're not. You're not. But we will call him back. Or Matteo, if you're listening to this, call us.
Call us.
Email us. Let us know what's going on.
Because, again, I mean, they have locked down the sixth largest economy in the world. Yeah. Imagine the economic hit that Italy, which already has a fragile economy, is going to take. And that is, when you heard Neil talk about trade-offs, Italy just made the trade.
Yeah, they did. Right. That's exactly right. They made the trade. Pulled the trigger.
Before.
Did the thing.
Pulled the trigger. And now, I mean, I guess we see. Before we go, a reminder that Kai and I also record daily explainers to make you smart. I suspect that a lot of those will also be about this topic in the coming weeks. Those are on your smart speaker. You know the one I mean? Just tell any Echo device to make me smart and check. I'm on some Twitter. Side note, I'm on some Twitter thread with apparently like a group that is just protests the use of the name. And so occasionally I get these tweets to me and like a bajillion other people just ranting about how it shouldn't be a human's name. And that like opens up all people with the same name to harassment and all of these issues. And I'm like, hey, man, I kind of hear you here. This is like fair, but whoa.
I am going to my cousin's daughter's wedding in October. Her name, which was fine for the first 20 years of her life, Siri.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah, it's a proud family tradition name handed down from my father's side. But yeah.
That's a really nice name.
It's a nice name. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't muted this thread because I don't disagree. Don't disagree. Anyway, tell that device to make you smart. Check it out. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson, who has decided it is time to go. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. He has meetings to get to, people. Thank you to our video producer, Ben Hethcote, and our video intern, Ethan Peretz. And thanks to writer-producer Erica Phillips. Feel better.
This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Side note, Ben tweeted today, it's just plain Ben. No Benjamin, no Benjamin, no nothing. It's just Ben Tolliday. So now we know. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. Senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. There you go.
Whose name is only Ben? That by itself is kind of unusual.
Trivia point, Ben Bernanke.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Am I, like, of course you know that.
Yeah, well, it's kind of my
job. Of course you did.
Yes.
I can't believe I didn't get a chance to plug your appearance on CNN in the show, as in didn't, you know. It's okay. Me and my son agree. You're too smart for TV. I have the same problem. Literally, we were watching and my son was like, I don't think that he understands anything that Kai is saying. He just keeps looking down. And I was like, yeah, you're probably right, babe.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.